And we're just getting our testifiers set up here. While they're setting up, I wanted to say, so far, as you know, in this committee, our objectives to date are to have an overview from the Department of Education, which we've done that. We've also had the department overview from Health and Human Services, and we also had Katie Williams from the YWCA testify. Today, the objective is to really talk about closing the achievement gap and what's involved with that from a research standpoint. So we have two very outstanding researchers here. Are they going to fill us on the latest on what's happening on that front? Before I introduce them, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things the committee is going to be doing. We are still hoping to have our tour on January 30th. It looks like right now, and you can give me input on this, we're going to be going out to a child care center that has several families on basic sliding fee and on the MFIP program, and talking about with parents and with the staff about how that is working for them. We also hope to have a hearing outside of the building here, and we'll probably do that for adult basic education, with going over down to the Hub Center on University and actually doing the hearing there. We're also going to try to add a citizen day where we're going to have citizens in to talk about how the programs are working for them, whether it's parents on basic sliding fee and MFIP, families that are doing in the ECFE parenting programs, families that are in school readiness with their kids, those types of things. So if you have ideas, I want to let you know we'll be doing that. And we're also looking at having an advocates day where we invite the advocates in. So for you advocates out in the audience, if you want to talk to Trish Kiefer, our committee legislative assistant, about when we'll be doing that, or Sarah Benzkoffer, actually probably Sarah, would sign you up for that. So we've got a number of interesting things happening, as well as the governor's budget. We'll be getting a look at that on Monday. It'll officially come out on Tuesday, and this committee will be hearing that next Thursday. So you want to make sure the Department of Education will be reviewing, and Commissioner Segrin will be here to talk about the governor's proposal. And it will be very interesting, especially based on the remarks that we heard yesterday. And let's see if we have our Arthur and Art team just about ready, hopefully, here. We have Arthur Reynolds is on the left. He's a professor with the University of Minnesota. He's recently, I think he's been here maybe less than a year. He can tell you more about his background. But he has done a longitudinal study on, from 3 years to third grade, what happens to kids and how they are doing, and the research behind what happens when you make good early preschool investments. And then we have Art Rolnick, who we call our rock star, right, Art? And who's all over the world talking about early childhood. If you were able to see the handouts, he has written a paper, two papers, maybe more than that, you can tell us, in his testimony about the value of early childhood from an economic perspective. And always remember, I emailed Art, and he emailed me back, I think, from Turkey, from his BlackBerry. So even places as far away as Turkey are very interested in his research and in what's happening and how to make the right investments. So we're very happy to have you here today with us. He also is a ballroom dancer and has won many awards. And we talked about actually doing a demonstration for you all, but, you know, we'll see. We might save that for another day. We'll see. Are you all ready, Arthur?
The computer is not cooperating.
Okay.
Show up on the screen.
Okay. Well, what we'll do is we'll do the minutes and hopefully see if we can get this going here. Let's see. Representative Wardlow, have you read the minutes?
Yes, I have.
Would you like to move them?
So moved.
So moved. Thank you. Okay. Representative Wardlow has moved approval to the minutes for our last meeting, which was Tuesday, January 16th. Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Okay. Motion prevails, and the minutes are approved. Okay. And just in time. Oh, Representative Garofalo got it working. Our technology expert on the committee, right?
Yeah.
From now on.
Many times on the House floor, I'm summoned for technical support and other duties as assigned.
Well, we will keep that in mind, that we have issues. Also, we wanted to let you know that the Health and Human Services, from their presentation, there's a copy of the poverty guidelines from 2006 and 2005 in your packet. So for the follow-up. And if there is items we asked for follow-up and we have not received it, let us know, and we'll be on top of that. So, Arthur Reynolds, Dr. Reynolds, are you ready?
Yeah.
Okay. If you could, welcome to the committee, and if you could state your name for the record.
Arthur Reynolds.
And your position?
And I'm a faculty member at the University of Minnesota in the Institute of Child Development. Long-standing interest in early childhood development. And maybe just to clarify, how long would you like us to speak?
Well,
we know up front.
We'll let you know, with the committee members, what we find is that they seem more attentive if they know they're going to get a chance to ask some questions. So hoping between 25 to 30 minutes, and then we will allow 10 to 15 minutes of questioning after your presentation. Then same with Dr. Rolnick, we would have 25, 30 minutes and then be able to question after you're done with your presentation. So I hope that will work. I know as a university professor, you probably have hours of material. So we appreciate if you can condense it.
I just want to highlight, and thanks for having me here. And what I wanted to do is, partly a little bit of a review, but also partly to look at the Minnesota situation in terms of early childhood and what some options are for funding, and what some of the evidence-based options might be for funding that either other states are doing or is supported by the research. What I want to lay out is just, in a nutshell, is one, the first thing is sort of how strong is the evidence on early childhood, some illustrations from some exemplary programs, and then moving then to the Minnesota situation and then the implications for practice in terms of improving practices and access in Minnesota. So that's kind of the themes I want to kind of approach. In the next 10 or 15 minutes, and I'll keep it as brief as possible. So just to summarize, and many of you may already know this, because both Art and I have been working on this part of the field for a while. And I think if I try to summarize kind of 50 years of research in terms of what preschool gives you that most other programs don't give you, it's all along these three lines. So I would say that the key research finding, this is over hundreds and thousands of studies in the last 4.5 decades, that consistently at least good quality programs produce large effects on school readiness. And that's undeniable. It's consistent, study after study. That's old news. It's been old news for 25 years. The second thing is that the positive effects, they're broad and enduring. That's not so old news, because broad means it just doesn't affect education, but it affects health, it affects family functioning. Programs can affect social and emotional functioning, things like crime, health status and behavior, basic social emotional development. The effects go beyond just education and high school completion. And that they endure. In other words, that you can see the effect of the program, the value added of the program, into adulthood. And that's very unusual for other social programs, whether you look at, say, reduced class sizes or kindergarten participation, things like that. So quite enduring. And some studies show effects up to from age 25 all the way up to age 40. And then I guess the last thing that makes early childhood unique, other programs, is the cost effect. There's been more cost effectiveness, economic benefits of participation in preschool programs have been more researched than in any other area. But even for different areas, it's searched then that the cost effectiveness is high. On average, you can expect the highest quality programs. I mean, the two most well-known programs show an average return of $10 per dollar invested. And so that's the background. And let me just, so I can summarize this with just, these are all the cost-benefit analyses that have been done in the last 25, 30 years from programs from birth to age 18, the last in Job Corps that's for kids that drop out and go back and get their GED. And from WIC all the way over. I think that the main pattern, I don't want to get into details about comparing categories within, say, 0 to 5, but the main point is consistent with maybe what you've read and seen in other reports, is that in the first 5 years of life, the bang for the buck, the return per dollar invested, and this chart just shows the dollar return per dollar invested. So what you want to see at the minimum is a $1.01 return per dollar invested. You want some payback from your investment. And so converting all the, you know, studies, high school dropout, earnings, crime reduction, impact on corrections, what you see is that programs like WIC, infant programs that are often have a heavy family emphasis, home visitation emphasis, or preschool programs like the Child Parent Center program or PERI, you get returns of about $3 to $9. But after that, beginning in school age, the returns go down dramatically. Not that you can't get a positive return, you can, but relatively speaking, the bang for the buck is much greater in the first 5 years of life. And that effects don't have to be always positive. They can be negative and harmful as far as economic well-being. Case in point, there's grade retention. Kids that get retained in school because they're more likely to be to drop out of school, which harms their economic well-being and productivity over the life course, that there's a loss of $3 per dollar invested associated with the practice, the common practice of grade retention without additional supports. Okay? And then the most well-known preschool programs in terms of the return, the dollar return per dollar invested, again, ranges from that number, the 3 to 10. And these are somewhat different programs. Apicidarian is more of an educational daycare program, birth to age 5. CPC preschool program and PERI are very similar in that they're pre-kindergarten programs, essentially, at 3 to 4 years of age in a center-based in an elementary school. The nurse family partnership is a nurse home visitation program. It is a different model of intervention. There's also shown a big return per dollar invested, but it's pretty much the only family program that's shown such a return. Now, the common elements from this evidence, I think the top six things that you need to know about how to get to these high returns based on the evidence is, from these is that one or more years of participation to have the opportunity for that. It's not just a one-year program. Well-trained and compensated teachers, small class sizes, diverse instruction, rich, not just one track, whether it be just all play or just all phonics training. It's kind of a lot of different kinds of experiences, field trips and the like. Comprehensive family services, that's a key point because all the programs that show these long-term returns, effects and returns, all had comprehensive services, either health services or they did parent involvement or they did home visits. And that at a minimum, the minimal, the smallest yearly cost for a half-day program was $5,000. So the cheapest of all the programs that show these long-term effects was the CPC program in Chicago, which approximately costs $5,000 per child for a half-day program for 3 hours. So in a full-day schedule, that would be $10,000 approximately. So those are the common elements that are very important in considering new options or innovations in Minnesota, in the state. I think that we pay particular attention to those. Evidence from CPC, I'll just show a couple things here. One, the Child Parent Center, it is a separate center model here. So you see in the picture there, the left side, Johnson Child Parent Center. So kids go into preschool and kindergarten in that center, and then they walk across the street to go to elementary school. So these buildings are integrated. The CPC program is integrated within the public schools. The public schools offer it. The advantages are the kids are in a school-stable learning environment for 5 or 6 years because they go to preschool and kindergarten in the same setting. If the public school is right there, so you're already kind of doing a PK3 of providing services that mean that help kids transition into kindergarten and into the early elementary grades. But if you just look at the preschool effects alone, I'll just direct you to the right side. So if you look at we followed 1,000 kids, the full cohort of the CPC program. These are kids born in 1980, and now we're 26 years old. We followed the whole cohort of those kids, and we compared them to kids from randomly selected schools that participated in the treatment as usual. The program as usual at that time, Chicago was all-day kindergarten. So what you're getting here is a comparison of kids in the Innovation CPC program versus kids that are similarly at risk that some got Head Start, but some got the more typical program that was available. So you get value added above and beyond treatment as usual. And you can see here, percentage of kids that at or above national norms. For all kids, that number would be 50. The average would be 50. And so the preschool kids are essentially at the national average. About half the kids are at the national average on school readiness composite. It's a literacy composite score, compared to the only 25% for the comparison group. So that 22-point gap is the gap that's really closed by participation in the preschool program. It's a very large effect at preschool. And that's consistent of other studies. And so that effect partly leads to differences in high school completion. So you see, over time, a 10-point gap, kids in the preschool program have about a 10 percentage point higher rate of high school completion all the way across the board from age 20 to age 23. As you can see here, and those percentages of kids that graduate or get a GED by age 23. It's about 72% for the program group, about 62% for the comparison group. And that difference is due to participation in the intervention itself. It leads to greater economic well-being later. The other one is a recent study. We just recently reported age 24 follow-up findings from the project that is the first for a large-scale public program. And what we also find is significant reductions in felony arrest and incarceration associated with participation in the preschool program. That's on the order of 20 to 25% reductions in the rate of felony arrest and incarceration associated with the program. Quite significant, and obviously the cost savings here on corrections are quite significant as well. The only thing about one thing about PK3 is that focusing only on preschool, you sort of miss the picture about where kids go after preschool. And I think in the CPC program, they did have a school-age version, and so the diverging lines here, if the kids, stop participation in the program at kindergarten, you see the red line, you see what their achievement pattern would be. If they continued on and got an enriched program of reduced class sizes and extra supports for education, you see the upper line, the yellow line. Maybe you can't see it as well. I direct you to the handout, it's hard to see. But the yellow line, that there's about a 4 to 6 month increment here. So if kids continued their enrollment in the program, if they got this school-age version of the CPC program after preschool and kindergarten, that led to higher levels of achievement by age 9. And so you see here the value added of school-age program above and beyond preschool. And the other option there is it also reduces the fading effects. Another way to say that is that the fading effects, the dissipation of the effect of preschool that you see in a lot of studies is prevented by the school-age program. Okay? So that's a well-known study. There's lots of other studies here. So you see all those parameters I said in the beginning, broad effects, lots of outcomes, big effects. So this is what the field tells us is working. What about Minnesota? Let's look at Minnesota. Let's just look at access. Let's just ignore quality right now and let's look at access. Any way you measure access in Minnesota, we're at the bottom tier of states as far as access for both 3 and 4 year olds. In this chart, I just take what has been reported already in near the National Institute of Early Education Research. Since 2001, I think they have done the yearly yearbook for preschool access and quality around the states. Minnesota, in access to state-funded pre-kindergarten programs for four-year-olds, we rank 36th out of 38 states. Only 2% of Minnesota four-year-olds participate in a state-funded preschool program that, is at least 2.5 hours a day. And that's the Head Start-funded program. Way below other states. Our near neighbor, Wisconsin, through their 4-year-old kindergarten program, is a ranking of 9. So 36 out of 38 states. Take another metric. look at not just state-funded preschool programs, but any government-funded preschool program. So what the role of the state is, what is the state or the federal government providing that leads to access to preschool. And so by this metric, when you add in Head Start participation, these are local agency grants from the, funded through the federal government, and early intervention, mainly for those that have developmental disabilities or special education needs, then you factor those programs in, then we're 18% of all four-year-olds are in a government-funded state or federal program. That ranks us 45th out of 50 states. Wisconsin and your neighbors, about half the kids have those participation. And it's totally a function of there's no state-funded preschool program. There is no state infrastructure or state pre-kindergarten program in the state of Minnesota outside of what the Head Start program is that we fund. So it just has to do with the fact that we don't have a state preschool program. Let's look at pre-K funding. What do we fund in Minnesota? And this is, again, from the Minnesota Department of Education. These numbers were widely discussed at the Governor's Summit in July here as well. We spend annually on the Minnesota School Readiness Program. That's the closest thing we have to a pre-kindergarten program, a preschool program. The expenditure per year is $9 million and an average cost per child of $283. And you can see that the minimum standard of a highly effective and cost-effective program is around $5,000. Michigan, Wisconsin, all these other states provide comparatively much greater allocation for preschool. They have fully funded or at least partially funded programs either through school funding formulas or through grants or through other means such as lotteries, taxes, cigarette taxes, other means as well. So we face a wage shortage. Illinois is a good example. In 2007, I think their actually allocation for the state pre-kindergarten program is over $300 million now since they've had increases of over $100 million the last year or two. Illinois is a much bigger state than Minnesota, of course, but proportionally, that's way behind other states. And those are just facts about where we are. A recent event in other states, so a couple things on other things. You know, Illinois, one thing they've done is they started, their mechanism was a block grant program. In 1984, they began a block grant program, so school districts or other eligible care centers could apply for block grant money to then provide preschool programs for 3- and 4-year-olds. And that's been in existence since 1984. They do it through block grants from the state legislature. Mostly school districts are the ones that get these block grants, and then they work with child care centers and others to implement their programs. This last fiscal year, the governor signed legislation to also increase this. It used to be for just at-risk kids. It still primarily is for at-risk kids, but now the preschool for all legislation means that any kid 3 or 4 years old that wants to participate, if there's spots available, can participate in this program. And so that helped increase the allocation above that $300 million per year that I mentioned. Other states have done different task forces to provide or plan either universal access or targeted access in different states. Maryland, Vermont are good examples of that. There are plans going on now. And in Washington, they just began to establish a cabinet-level Department of Early Learning. And I think Art and I both started the Early Childhood Research Collaborative, and I think as a mechanism for disseminating research and for conducting research on early childhood topics from birth to age 9. And I think you'll see more information, papers, reports on the website that we have, and as a way to disseminate information to policymakers and others, and so we want to make you available for that. But things I didn't say, but things that we could follow up on, that would be a good kind of a good segue. And to know that it exists and it's fully operational, and we're really excited about it. So that gives you a sense of the field in Minnesota, and maybe some directions from what other states are suggesting and otherwise.
Great, thank you. And it's very interesting as The governor talked about yesterday, when you look at the costs of all-day kindergarten versus the investments in early childhood and kind of what the trade-offs are there, and I think this is obviously helps make the case for why preschool is a good investment. We'd like to start a list. I hope people have questions since we're taking time, and we'll start with Representative Winkler, and then let me make a comment about what we're going to do at our next meeting, which will be next Tuesday. Is we are going to hear from MELF, with the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, about the programs they're doing. We are going to talk about the Governor's Summit that you were both involved with. We're going to have some testimony from United Way, and we're going to talk about the school readiness assessment and how that's put together. So with that, Representative Winkler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Mr. Reynolds. Or is it Dr. Reynolds? We've had testimony, which you haven't been here for in the last committee meetings, talking about all the various early education programs that Minnesota funds. And I strongly support, very much support, what we're doing in these areas, but I get the sense that there are so many various programs and things that we're doing. And I'm looking at this $9 million state expenditure for Minnesota school readiness. I'm wondering, how does, you know, the preschool approach that you're discussing here compare with what is going on in other programs in Minnesota? And, I mean, clearly we're spending more than $9 million a year on early childhood education in general in the state. Should we be putting all our money into preschool? Or how does what we, you know, the implication of what we should be doing here compared to what we are doing now?
Dr. Reynolds?
I'm sorry for the difficulty of answering that question succinctly.
Sure. I think, you know, there's a couple factors. One, there are a lot of programs, and I think it speaks to the there's a lot of fragmentation of programs that have different goals and different objectives, but also very few statutory requirements as well. Because just add them up. You've got a first grade prep, that's a few, maybe, you know, $7 million allocation. You've got ECFE that is not... is more of a more universal. It's more of a birth to three program through home visits and visits at schools and things. It's not. I wouldn't classify it as a pre-kindergarten program. That's about $34 million annual allocation through a levy and others. And then you've got the school readiness program, and you have what the state funds in terms of Head Start. But I think it speaks to the fragmentation. There's no cohesive set of services that say high-risk kids can get that link it together. So what other states have done, and Minnesota hasn't done, is they've pulled those resources together to provide a unified, consistent program that does have a lot of statutory requirements about the teachers, about the curriculum, about the length of day, about the number of days per week that you have to meet. And it's all lined within a separate program. So if you added up the funds for first grade prep, ECFE, although ECFE is not necessarily pre-kindergarten, it has another function in terms of providing family supports, school readiness, and the like, I think you would better align to what other states are doing. But even if you added those up, the gap in funding compared to what other states are doing is not nearly enough. I mean, just look at Wisconsin. I think overall maybe it's 100 million. Add those up and you get 40 or 50 million. The goal, I think, would be to fully fund a program or set of approaches that would allow kids, at least high-risk kids, to benefit from what we've learned from the research, having strong program of high quality. And that means at least, you know, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week within a comprehensive service system. And what we have in Minnesota, it's more fragmented. So I think the fragmentation can be solved. But even if you put the fragmentation together, the funding is insufficient to enable kids at high risk to get the benefits that we know are possible from other states and other studies.
Representative Winkler?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick follow-up then. Has someone else put together some kind of a proposal showing what a reorganization and realignment of programs and expenditures would look like in Minnesota, so that if we did that, we could say now that we have it reorganized, and now that if we were to actually fully fund it, we would actually, you know, be doing something, and we could, you know, you talk about accountability in here, we could actually begin to have more measures of that in place as well. I mean, where is that as a policy development, that your knowledge?
Dr. Reynolds?
My knowledge, sorry.
we just go through. Here at the legislature, we go through the chair, and so I'm obligated to direct that, and so I will. I always say your name before. So, Dr. Reynolds.
Thank you. I think there may have been some initial information, but I think a fully developed sort of policy analysis and proposal, I don't think, has been put together. I think it could easily be done based on existing information, because in part that was what the purpose of the Governor's Summit was to get these programs across the different agencies in the government together and to do an analysis of where they are in terms of best practices and then to make recommendations. I have made specific recommendations about where I think you could fully fund a program called Minnesota School Readiness that would look like, that would have the features of the effectiveness principles that we know are true, you know, from other studies as well. And so I think it's not, it would, I don't think it would be a difficult exercise, but that exercise I think needs more, I think, legislative leadership.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Winkler. We'll have Representative Nornes and then Representative Eastland, and I just want to comment on that. Last summer, the Minnesota legislature sent a team of legislators to Denver to the National Conference of State Legislators Conference on Early Childhood. It was Representative Gunther, Representative Sikora, Representative Denver, and Senator Clark, and myself. And we did meet with other states about what they were doing, and the statistics are somewhat shocking in how we're falling behind. I think it appeals to our Minnesota pride when we see that maybe we need to do something. Representative Nornes?
Madam Chair, I debated even asking a question, but I decided I would. In your one handout here talking about the state of Minnesota ranking 36 out of 38 states when it comes to pre-K access, I know a lot of the child care centers also have preschool programs as part of their curriculum. There is no recognition of that in these numbers, is there, as far as the amount of money spent or
Dr. Reynolds?
Ranking?
No, this is only pre-kindergarten programs for four-year-olds that are funded by the state.
Okay.
Now, the reason child care isn't in there is because most child care is custodial care, does not have significant educational content, and that is a problem with trying to put those numbers in. Very uneven quality. I mean, only 15% of child care centers' experiences kids have are considered high quality. There's not a lot of research that shows the benefits of that as well. But I think the problem with child care is the unevenness, and it's for a large part because of the lack of standards, and the quality is questionable in many cases. And it wouldn't be an apples comparison to add that in.
Okay. Madam Chair, I just wanted to point out that most of them, I think all of them, are required to have licensed teachers working there, so you would assume that naturally would become, you know, with time or however it's needed to be part of the solution, because it seems that they're already there. Just have to, if there's more requirements that are needed, that would be one thing. But they do have the requirement of having the qualified teachers on staff. So,
Dr. Reynolds?
We just say that there's a lot of elements of quality, you know, in terms of pay, look at compensation, turnover, child staff ratios, comprehensiveness of services, child care centers, you know, on the 10 characteristics of quality of effectiveness that were reviewed at the Governor's Summit, I think many of these programs would probably only have two or three of these quality characteristics out of 10.
Yeah.
And so I think in the other ones, they fall far short. It's changing. I agree with you to some extent. It's changing. Child care now is early education and care together, and that there is a lot more education that's being done than used to be, and that will continue to be the case. But again, as far as standards of the quality features, they're far short of what pre-kindergarten programs do related in school districts or in other kinds of settings, community action agencies.
Thank you.
Okay. Representative Eastland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Reynolds, I got a couple questions. One is, could you comment a little bit about Head Start and kind of its characteristics? And I mean, Head Start is really the only thing that we have in this state that's spending anywhere close to the kind of dollars that you're talking about. And most of the reviews that I read on Head Start are pretty marginal. Could you just comment on that and give your perspective on what would need to change in that program? Or
Dr. Reynolds?
Yes, thank you. A couple things. I think the definitive kind of word on Head Start, you know, today is from the National Impact Study that was completed last year, the first round of it. It clearly showed that Head Start, it has most of the quality features that of the 10 quality features of program conference service and the like. But the key findings were that indeed Head Start in their impact study, it's a randomized control study, showed that kids in literacy and in health services and in dental care, you know, did significantly better than kids that weren't in Head Start. So the effect sizes or the size of the impact were strong on both school readiness skills and in health and getting access to preventive care, either dental care or health care. So, you know, clear. This is a national study of all kids. And it didn't even compare among kids that had 1 versus 2 years. Other kids that were, say, in the comparison group also got Head Start, but not in their neighborhoods. So there's a lot of factors that maybe make the bias somewhat conservative. But clearly, Head Start by the National Impact Evaluation is showing, you know, good effectiveness. It's not outstanding effectiveness based on the effects that have been shown in these long-term studies, like the Child Parent Centers or High Scope, not the same level of effectiveness, but good enough to be meaningful and to make a difference, you know, in kids' lives. And I think on cost is relatively high, but you're getting quality across the characteristics. You're getting intensity. You're getting comprehensive family services. You're getting health services. There's standards for teaching and for the length of day, length of the year. And so I think overall its effectiveness is good, but not outstanding.
Okay, yeah, and I guess, and that's, Madam Chair, and I guess that was kind of my concern, because most of the times we hear the benefit, we hear the $1 to $8, $1 to $10, and those are relatively small studies, relatively, maybe they're longer term, maybe they're better controlled or whatever. I guess maybe are there some situations, some states that are spending a lot of money doing quality on a large scale that are seeing the kind of returns that we're talking about when we hear the dollar return that is potentially there if the program is done correctly?
Dr. Reynolds?
I would say two things there. One is that the studies, not all the studies are small scale. I think that the Child Parent Center study is a large scale, 1,500 kids. This is a program that's going on in the Chicago Public School since 1967, similar to Head Start in a lot of ways. That shows this return, you know, a $10 return per dollar invested in the long-term evidence. And the other thing is you got to look at these studies as a group, too. You've got studies with philosophies that are somewhat different, samples different, locations different, time of intervention different, yet they're pretty much showing the same effects. To me, that's a strength in showing that, hey, these findings are generalizable for quality. Now, on the other hand, states that are doing a lot for preschool programs, such as Georgia and Oklahoma, have been doing a lot of research on the effects of the program. So take Oklahoma in particular, it has the highest rate of access. Four-year-olds, about 92% all four-year-olds participate in Oklahoma's pre-kindergarten program. The signs are that the achievement gains in, you know, kindergarten, first grade are of the size that you see in these other studies. They haven't been around long enough to do the long-term follow-up studies to age 20. But what we see is that the markers of success are similar to what we see in the other studies. And these are state-run programs. And so the sign's good, but they have the long-term evidence is not available yet from these programs. But based on what we know from the short-term gains, it looks like the same pattern that we see in the other studies. And that's encouraging to me.
Representative Eastland?
Yeah, one more question. A lot of the research has been done on the most high-risk kids, the kids of the greatest need. Do we have any data or information about kids that currently are coming to school ready? The characteristics that can happen in a normal upbringing with a family kind of doing the things that families do, so that we could understand how much of this is related to poverty, how much could be related to kind of social status or wherever you find yourself, if you're in a single parent home or if you're in a single parent home with many kids, or I guess is there any data so we can understand how are the people that are doing it right now, what do they look like, and what kind of are the characteristics of those kind of kids?
Dr. Reynolds?
Yes. If you look at, there have been studies that look at the impact of preschool programs for middle income, for kids that aren't at risk, and so what we get. And we also know the impact of kids, mainly middle class kids, college educated families, in terms of the impact of daycare at age 3. So studies in Oklahoma, in a 5-state study that was done by the National Institute of Early Education Research, looked at both, kids at high risk and at low risk, and found significant gains in school readiness for both groups. The size of the effect is still greater for those higher at risk, but based on state-run programs, the 5-state study that includes, Georgia and other states, or the Oklahoma study, show that middle-income kids, the kids that are coming into school without a lot of risk factors, if any, are getting a significant advantage of about, 3 or so months of performance compared to maybe, 5 or 6 months for a high-risk kid. So there is an advantage. It's not as great, but it's still a meaningful advantage. The other side of it is that we have studies of daycare. We've had families have had daycare experiences, for years and years. And there have been studies, recent studies, that look at kids that have high quality daycare at age 3 or from birth to 3. What is their profile in achievement, literacy, social emotional development later? And some well-known studies, national studies, the NICHD childcare study, that's a National Institute of Health funded study, shows clearly that kids with high-quality child care from middle-class families have significant changes in literacy, and this lasts up to the 3rd to 6th grade as well. The size is not as great as it is for these model programs or for high-risk kids, but it's sizable and educationally meaningful, and we have to take that information into account in policymaking.
Thank you. What I'd like to do with 2 more members, and we need to move on and hear our roll mix testimony, Representative Murphy.
Madam Chair and Dr. Reynolds, we know obviously that there are many families in Minnesota that are sending their kids to early education. I'm an example of that, where my kids went to preschool beginning at about 3 and a half and had a great benefit from that. They were ready for kindergarten. So I would like your advice on how we make the transition, if you will, from where we are now to where we might go in terms of kids at risk and families that are already choosing to send their kids to preschools, and how do we make the standards there alike? What would be your advice there?
Dr. Reynolds?
Yes, I think we want to have a more unified early childhood system that combines and is more integrated across program types. So you have, programs in community settings, either family child care or child care settings that are run, privately or otherwise. You have public school programs that are run as a K-12 model with preschools as well. And the idea is here, the system's fragmented, and the idea is to try to bridge the systems along a common set of standards, but in the beginning, at least, making a more integrated system with clear standards more available to those higher at risk, based on these clear standards and based on clear goals, like having a large percentage of the teaching force to have bachelor's degrees and certification in early childhood. We can't say that of a lot of community child cares, that's not a specific standard in terms of the class sizes. Is another example where we have the minimum standard. Most child care centers and even many pre-kindergarten homes go to state minimum standard, which is this 10-to-1 ratio, or 20-to-2, that although it's better than a higher number, that isn't consistent with the evidence. It typically larger effects gotten by when the ratios for age 3 or 4 are around 8 to 1 or 18 to 2 instead of 20 to 2. So I think it's having, you know, a clear set of standards that meet the effectiveness criteria that were discussed at length at the governor's summit, but also to create an early childhood system that would have, take the Illinois example. You have the legislator directed block grants to local communities. It could be school systems or it could be other child care centers to apply for money to follow standards to get an allocation as a block grant to implement programs at the community level. In Illinois, it's mostly through the public schools, but again, a similar approach would allow collaboration between child care centers, family care centers, and public schools, and Head Start and other action agencies to collaborate and come together to implement programs with appropriate funding that meets these standards that we know are going to make it likely that the kids would benefit. So I think it's kind of making the system more unified, providing a funding and a mechanism for developing programs, and that I think would make an easier transition among centers and among providers, so it's a more consistent and unified system.
Thank you. Last question, Representative Kranz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think I have just a comment and a brief question, which will, I think, be appropriate. I just want to thank you for your research and the work you've done. I like the idea that at a time when we're looking at 4 years of a foreign language for high school graduation, that we're also talking about our fourth graders and kids entering kindergarten understanding and being able to speak English as well. But there is a lot of discussion on the two primary issues in this area is providing funding for all-day, everyday K or putting those resources into maybe a pre-K program. And I think I might know your answer, but I'm kind of curious if you have any ideas or thoughts on that. Which is the best investment or thing that we should be looking at as far as do we fund all-day, everyday K, or would we be better served leaving the K structure as it is and really increasing the pre-K programs?
Dr. Reynolds?
Thank you. I guess strictly just based on the research and the knowledge we have about the effects of different programs, clearly, you know, there's a much bigger bang for the buck by, you know, developing a preschool system, developing a pre-kindergarten system. So directing dollars to a preschool system has a lot bigger payoff than I think adding half day to already half day kindergarten program. But that's the other thing I would say. But of course, there's other criteria you have to use. The other thing I would say, though, is that the kids at risk, though, especially I think, you know, would benefit after having a good preschool program, having the opportunity for a fully funded kindergarten program is very important. So I think to help continue the gains from preschool experience, all day kindergarten certainly has a place. Especially if you think about things from a more of a PK3 approach, that we want to align services across ages, that I hope it's not just an either or, that we can have continuity and that all day kindergarten does contribute to increased continuity between preschool and the elementary grades for high risk kids and for low risk kids. But just strictly on the basis of the research evidence, clearly the bigger bang for the buck is with high quality preschool programs.
Representative Kranz, I think that is the essence of what's going to be a very interesting debate during this session, and that's one of the reasons we're having testimony like this to bring out the points on our case, because it's the Early Childhood Committee of Early Childhood. Next, we'd like to have testimony from Dr. Art Rolnick. I see that Rob Grunwald's here, too. Rob, are you going to come down? And he also works with the Federal Reserve Bank and has done collaboration on both the papers and the presentations. I think that when we first formed the Early Childhood Caucus, the very first presentation we ever had was from Rob Grunwald, because Art Rolnick was sick that day. And I always remember that, because he has such a great reputation, and we're so pleased that you're in town and able to talk to us about this very important topic. So,
thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm glad I'm not sick this time with the flu. I'm Art Rolnick. I'm the Director of Research at the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. You must be wondering why somebody in my position has gotten involved in the economics of early childhood education. I'll talk a little bit about that, because that story leads me into the research that Dr. Reynolds had mentioned, I want to summarize briefly the first essay that Rob Grunewald and I wrote. We took an economic lens to this issue. So I'm going to make the case that early childhood development is economic development, and I'm going to argue it's economic development with a very high public, and I want to stress public return. When Rob and I looked at the literature, we thought this point was pretty obvious. I thought I was done. That was about 3 years ago, and our phone rings off the hook on this issue. As the chair mentioned, found myself last year in Istanbul as the guest of the Prime Minister of Turkey with the Queen of Norway in the audience. Queen of Jordan in the audience, and members from the Saudi Arabian family. So I am used to speaking to royalty, I'm assuming. After making that point, my second point is going to be essentially our second essay, which some of you have already asked about. All right, so what should we do here in Minnesota or elsewhere to take currently what we're doing and try to get the results out of the research that it's not clear that we're getting today from current programs? It's been mentioned Head Start and others. It's not going to surprise you that Rob and I are economists, and again, taking an economic lens, we're going to talk about an economic approach to this, which is going to empower parents and argue the research is very, very convincing on this line. So that's going to be my second point. And then I want to turn it over to Rob, who's going to talk a little bit about the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation and the initiative, which is really based on these ideas and what's happening here in Minnesota. I'll touch on what's happening in some other states as well along these lines. So we took an economic lens, and I actually started, for years I've been writing about economic development and that the way we've been doing it around this country is counterproductive, and that the public return on billions of public dollars that have been spent on economic development, the public return is virtually zero. I like to use a local example, although this goes on nationally, and we actually got a bill introduced in Congress back in 91 by former Congressman David Mingy, trying to end what we call the economic bidding war. This is when private companies use their economic clout, their jobs, et cetera, to convince you to give them a subsidy so they'll stay or locate in your area. We've argued in this essay a number of years ago that's a zero-sum game from a national perspective. It doesn't create jobs from a national perspective. It's a zero public return. In fact, we argued it violated our Constitution. We argued it violated the Commerce Clause. A recent federal court ruling agreed with us on that. It actually got to the Supreme Court. Unfortunately, they ruled that the lawyers who brought that case did not have standing. So you're stuck with this economic bidding war, unfortunately. We see it, of course, with the sports teams, and I won't go too far on that, but we see it with automobile companies and Lawson Software as an example in St. Paul, and, of course, you're now facing it with Northwest Airlines. That's the wrong way to do economic development. The market will deal with that. We should not be allowing cities and states to use public money for private purposes. Up until 3 years ago, if you'd asked me, okay, Roman, if that's the wrong way to do economic development, what should the public policy be? And I would have said up until 3 years ago, invest in human capital. We know that a high-quality workforce, good educated workforce, trained workforce, is a driver of economic growth. I won't go into all the data, but if you look post-World War II with the economic miracles around the world, Japan, Korea, Ireland today, Poland today, and of course China and India, key ingredient is the quality of its workforce. Here in Minnesota, we should know that. We have one of the best educated workforces in the country, and we have one of the best economies in terms of per capita income, in terms of productivity, you name it. We are a very healthy economy. Wasn't always true. After post-World War II, we started pouring money into education. Today, women in our economy are number one in high school degrees. I think overall, in terms of education, we're like number five in the country. So up until 3 years ago, that was my answer. Then I was at a lunch, organization called Ready for K. Many of you may have heard of it. It was partly established with the support of former Mayor and Congressman Don Fraser and former Governor Al Quie. And they presented a report at this lunch arguing for more funding for early childhood development. I'm listening to their argument, and I wasn't very happy with it. It was the moral argument. It was sort of the right thing to do, and I'm saying, you know, we can make moral arguments for lots of things. We can make moral arguments for K through 12. We can make moral arguments for reducing crime. I said to both Don and Al that I think you need to make an economic argument. Now, that's not my field. I worry about inflation and unemployment, and I do a lot of research on pre-Civil War banking. I know nothing about early childhood development. Nevertheless, they roped me into it, and then I went and got Rob, and I said, look, Rob, it won't take long. I'm sure we'll write this essay, and we'll be done. So what did we say in this essay that's gotten so much attention? Again, the bottom line was early childhood development is economic development, and it's economic development with a high public return. In a way, Dr. Reynolds kind of answered that for you. He showed you those longitudinal studies. We went and looked at those longitudinal studies. We took a slightly different lens. You looked at benefit-cost ratios, 10 to 1, 9 to 1, 8 to 1, whatever that was. Those benefit-cost ratios are useful when you have other benefit-cost ratios to compare them to. Unfortunately, we don't have benefit-cost ratios on your next dollar invested in K through 12 or on reducing crime or on reducing pollution. So as economists, under certain conditions, we know we can translate benefit-cost ratios in rates of return. That's something that's more easily communicated to business people, the market, to policymakers. We had the data on one particular study known as the Perry High Scope Study. It's one of the most famous studies. Small sample, but high quality. Focused on at-risk kids. Randomly had a group in a control group and a group that got a high-quality program. Followed the kids for 40 years, and as Dr. Reynolds mentioned, we saw tremendous public benefits in terms of reduction in crime. There was a reduction in the need for special ed. The kids were more likely to graduate high school, get a job, pay taxes, stay off welfare. And again, the crime rate in that one study went down 50%. So we calculated for the investment, and by the way, the investment in today's dollars, this was a study that was done in the early 60s, but in today's dollars, it was $10,000 per year per child, 2 years, two-year program. The return, the annual rate of return, inflation adjusted, was 16%. Now, I can tell you, my venture capital friends, if they saw a 16% inflation adjusted return, it would not go unfunded for very long. So when Rob and I argue we're way underfunding early childhood development in this country, it is because of studies like this that suggest if it's done with high quality, we can do a much better job. If it's focused on at-risk kids, we know we can get a much better return. It wasn't just one study, as Dr. Reynolds pointed out. There are a number of longitudinal studies, high-quality studies, that all point in the same direction. Rates of return vary anywhere from a real rate of return of 7 up to 16, although we argue these are conservative estimates for a number of reasons, which I'll just touch on. We didn't have data on children of the children. We're just starting to get that. It looks like there's going to be positive effects there. We didn't have data on siblings in the families that got the program. We're pretty sure that's good. Going to be very positive. We didn't have data, and we got that later, on the parents in the program. Their incomes went up 40% in the Perry High School program. Went up because they become better parents. They become better employees. So we were convinced just on that data that there looks like there's a high public return. And we first started thinking about 3- and 4-year-olds and a system to improve early childhood programs for 3- and 4-year-olds. But when I gave a talk like this, I was in Boston, and a man by the name of Jack Shunkoff, who was at that time dean at the Heller School at Brandeis, he's now at Harvard running an institute on child brain development, he pulled me aside and he said, Art, program sounds good, but you better start much earlier. And I said, what do you mean by that? And he mentored me, if you will, on literature on brain development. It's very powerful literature. They show that children in stressful environments to the ages of 0 and 3, when they compare them to children in non-stressful, normal environments, the children in the stressful environment, their physical brains do not develop as they should. They tend to be too small. The neurons don't connect as they should. What Jack Shunkoff would say, the debate between nature and nurture is over. The evidence, the last 10 years of evidence on brain development is very, very powerful. So now you got the brain development research saying the early years are critical, and you got to start early. And you got the intervention research, as Dr. Reynolds has pointed out, that says it's critical and we know how to do something about it. So now there was a question raised earlier in the committee. Okay, you've got all this research. It sounds like you know, you could potentially, theoretically, do a better job, but currently it sure doesn't look like we're getting those results. Head Start, I would argue the results are mixed. They're definitely improvements, but nothing like the 16% inflation adjusted rate of return that we're talking about. There have been attempts to bring it to scale. They haven't worked so well. There was an attempt in Pittsburgh to try to bring it to scale. They funded a lot of buildings, a lot of training, a lot of programs. They never got to the families. So, challenge for Rob and I, fine, we're convinced that we can do this. What sort of a system, as some of you have asked, would you put in place? Now remember, you're listening to a couple of economists. We see a lot of power in the market. We know the market can deliver an awful lot in terms of efficiency and overall well-being. This is a market-driven economy generally. So we're going to talk about a system, and we've proposed a system that's easy to bring to scale. We would argue that any sort of proposal, you better bring it to scale. It's not good enough if we're only doing this for 20% of the at-risk kids. You've got to do it for every at-risk kid. And so what sort of a system would we put in place? It's got to be, got to bring it to scale. It's got to be permanent in some sense, because if it's not permanent, if there's not a permanent commitment to it, you won't get the market to respond. It's got to be parent-focused. Another challenge for us. It's got to be parent-focused, because if you don't get the parent engaged, you're not going to get these kind of results. So these were sort of the things we kind of toyed with and thought about, and we came up with the following system, which we basically stole from higher ed. So we claim no originality here. How do you make it permanent? Well, you start with an endowed fund. Had long talks with Mike Cerisi about this. This endowed fund, especially in Minnesota, it would be just for education. There, actually, you have an endowed fund now for education. We would create an endowed fund, the proceeds of which would have to be used for high-quality early childhood education. So what does that mean? What would we do with the proceeds? Well, as I said, we would empower the parent. The parent becomes the customer. And how do you empower the parent? Very simple idea, with scholarships. So the parent gets a letter, congratulations, your child has been awarded a scholarship. At three, they can use these scholarships, but only, and here's where we take account of the high quality and encourage high quality, you can only use these scholarships in a high quality program in your community, and we will list the high quality programs. And to be a high quality program, as Dr. Reynolds mentioned, you have to meet certain criteria. But then the parent chooses which program. They don't like the Head Start, they can go to a Montessori, they can go to a faith-based, whatever program works for that parent. So it's very customized. Now you're going to say to me, well, that's fine. You've got it covered for the three and four years. What about the early years? So our program is really scholarship/mentor. We start with mentors prenatal. Why do we start prenatal? We've got other studies that show that if you start prenatal and continue with high quality early ed, you can get these kind of results. Now, if you're looking for a return on the prenatal, there was a study done. This was done with Procter & Gamble money in Cincinnati, Ohio. It was not done for early childhood reasons. It was done for health reasons. They got public health nurses as mentors with the mom's prenatal. They had a control group. Infant mortality went down 70% in the study. This was recently reported in the Wall Street Journal back in June. So we're pretty sure we can design a program. In fact, that's what MELF is going to do. We're going to pilot a program in which we do mentors prenatal, scholarships starting at three, and we're going to be able to show you results pretty quickly on infant mortality, on the type of results, the outcome results that Dr. Reynolds are talking about, that these kids will be ready for school. Once they're ready for school, we're pretty sure they're going to do well. If we get all these at-risk kids into a K-12 program, and they're ready to learn, K-12 will do much better. I'm not saying we've got all things solved with K-12, but if you start all these kids ready, you'll find your teachers will be more productive, you'll have more resources to put into positive things rather than retention and special ed. So we think there is a program that would deliver this way. Rob and I have been around the country on this. Governor Jody Rell of Connecticut has announced a scholarship program for 5,000 kids in the Hartford area. State of Ohio is announcing in June a program like this in Ohio. Nebraska just announced a scholarship program. States of South Dakota, North Dakota, Montana are all looking at this. And our biggest coup is we hope is going to be with the Gates Foundation. They have looking at this research. They are now convinced that they should be starting earlier with their education program. They've announced a $90 million initiative in the Seattle area. Rob and I are lobbying them to make sure that they do a pilot of the scholarship program as well as some other things. So, in a nutshell, that's what we've concluded looking at this research. That's a system that we think has a good chance of getting the results we're talking about, with the parent essentially becoming the customer, with the parent having the power, engaging that parent and keeping the parent engaged, and making the market compete for those scholarship kids. And by the way, the scholarships will only pay if these programs are successful. So there'll be accountability, they'll be very transparent, and MELF is, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, is going to be running such a pilot, at least a one, if not two or three, around the state. Well, I'm going to turn it over to Rob right now, and then we can open up for questions after that. Rob's going to talk about MELF and some of these principles that we mentioned.
Thanks, Art. And Rob and I are familiar with each other through a number of things. He has presented and lectured at the class I teach. Also, we were able to go to the Fed. If you get the chance to go to the Federal Reserve, that's where they print the money. And we got to see the money in the bottom of the basement, which maybe that was a rare treat, but it's a very interesting place. And to think about how involved the Federal Reserve is in our countries and our world's economy. Rob Grunewald, if you can state your name and title for the record. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair and representatives. I am Rob Grunewald, Associate Economist with the Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis. And I'm just going to review a couple programs that were somewhat inspired, at least partially inspired, by the papers that Art Molnick and I wrote. What you see on the slide is the principles, and Art has really talked about them, that are illustrated in the papers that we've presented, the principles of reaching children at risk, where we'll find the highest public return, reaching children earlier is better, the importance of quality, accountability for outcomes, and the importance of parent involvement and family focus. Shortly after we released our first paper, Blandon Foundation came and approached us about the research that we presented. I just want to mention this initiative in Itasca County very briefly. Basically, for the last year and a few months or so, this program has been up and running. It was inspired by a grant from the Blandon Foundation, a $1.5 million grant. It will be renewable over 10 years. It's a program that focuses on children who are at risk in Itasca County. It brought together different organizations in that area, including four school districts, also the Head Start community in that region, and they were able to put together a program that was fairly seamless and usable for parents so that they could enroll at-risk children in high-quality programs, and it was focused from birth to five. The Wilder Research Program is going to be reviewing the results on this initiative, so I just want to put it on your radar screen because the hope is to learn how a program like this in a more rural setting can help children. And of course, the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation, which you'll be hearing about next Tuesday in front of your committee, so I'm not going to steal the thunder of that presentation. But the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation was inspired by a business group called Minnesota Business for Early Learning that was also formed partially inspired by the research from the Minneapolis Fed. And were instrumental in helping create the vision for the Minnesota Early Learning Foundation. One project that they're going to be working on is to use some of the ideas that Art and I have articulated in terms of providing scholarships to children at the ages of 3 and 4, providing mentors for children with or families with at-risk children beginning prenatal, and that it would be a market-based approach. Programs could come from a variety of areas, from the public and private sectors, whether that be Head Start, child care centers, privately or publicly funded preschool programs, and that parents with these scholarships would be able to select among those programs that are of high quality to enroll their children. So a pilot project will be funded by MELF, which is currently in a planning phase during 2007. The initiative will run from 2008 to 2011 in selected neighborhoods in the city of St. Paul. There's a task force that's been convened to help put this program together, getting feedback from a number of organizations in the early childhood community as well. It's staffed by experts at the University of Minnesota and other organizations, staffed from the city of St. Paul and the Federal Reserve Bank, which should be me. And one of the goals of this project is to conduct a rigorous evaluation of it so we can understand how this mechanism works and also understand what the outcomes were for children. And so a request for proposal was submitted out to those research organizations around the country back in December, and there will be an evaluator selected by the spring. And the goal there is to inform not only this committee but other groups throughout Minnesota and also around the nation how this scholarship system can work and the benefits that it has. Thank you.
Thank you. Members, other questions? There must be some questions, members. Representative Eastland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question for Mr. Rolnick. I asked the same question to Mr. Reynolds, and I'm not sure we connected on the question there. But I'll ask a series of questions. How many kids are in just kind of the curve of where kids fall in the economic strata of things? How many kids would fall into the at-risk category? What percent?
Dr. Rolnick?
The way Ram and I have looked at that is, in Minnesota, we first defined at-risk, and this was sort of to do the financial plan. Those children that are living poverty and below. Income is a pretty good indicator. It's not the only indicator, but it's a pretty good indicator of what we mean by at risk. If you talk to people in the justice system, they tell you, look, the people that we see, the kids that we see, they're getting into trouble. They're not middle and upper middle class kids. They're, on average, strong percentage are coming from low income families. So we start there, and Rob, what did we estimate for Minnesota on poverty and below?
Mr. Grunewald?
For 3- and 4-year-old children, looking at census data, we're looking at around 16,000, 17,000 children.
Now, I think the research suggests you can get the kind of the high returns we're talking about. You can probably go 200% over poverty, maybe more. After that, you still, as Dr. Reynolds mentioned, you can still get some positive effects, but you're not going to get the kind of returns we're talking about. We know we have limited dollars, and we're arguing as economists, just like business people would, you start with the high return first. That's the highest public return, focusing on the most at-risk kids. So you really start with neglected and abused children. That's where you're going to have a very, very high return moving forward. But you can move up the income scale, and we think you could probably go 200, maybe even 300% over poverty and still get very high public returns.
Representative Eastland?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Then, and maybe this, I don't know if you know the answer to this, but maybe somebody on the committee does. But when we talk about being ready for kindergarten as being kind of a measurement standard of where we are, where do we fall in that category right now in Minnesota? What percentage of our kids are classified as not ready for kindergarten when they come? I don't know who has that.
Dr. Rolnick, do you want to take that?
When I recall it, we have a Minnesota readiness assessment test here in the state, and we take a random group of kids coming into kindergarten, and they find that roughly 50% of the kids don't pass this very, very basic test, and it tests both cognitive and social skills. And I want to emphasize, social skills are probably as important, and some are even more important than the cognitive skills here in terms of future success. Now, some of those kids are close to the test, so they're not that far behind to the test, so they're not that far behind. But there are quite a few that are very far behind. I think it's very disturbing a state like Minnesota. Numbers are that low.
Representative Eastland?
Yeah, I don't know how we compare with other states on that. I guess the question I'm getting to is the issue of we have half the kids roughly that we have identified as not being ready for K when they get there, but we have the other half of kids that are ready for K. Now there could be some improvement on their ability as well, I'm sure, as was commented earlier by Mr. Reynolds. But clearly half the kids are coming from families that are doing some stuff right. because their kids are ready. I mean, they don't have the risk factors. I mean, they come from more economically affluent homes and all that kind of thing. But I guess what can we do short of universal preschool, state funded, so that we can take advantage of the fact that if it's a good economic investment for the state to put money into kids, it's also a good economic for parents, families to put money into kids. And we have some parents that are doing that. And we want to encourage them to keep doing that and doing the job right. They may not need all the state resources, but how can we kind of identify that up front so we identify the scope of where this early childhood benefit is going to really be the biggest bang for the buck, and we can move the kids that need it ahead, and at the same time we can encourage parents to doing the right thing to keep doing the right thing.
Right.
Dr. Rowley?
Yeah, well, you have some great programs. ECFE is out there trying to do does a wonderful job educating parents on the importance of parenting with kids. Ready for K is an organization that its goal is to promote the importance of early childhood education for all children. And, absolutely, it's for all children. Notice, though, if we start a scholarship program for at-risk kids, I mean, that's going to be publicized and marketed, if you will, throughout the state, and it's going to become very clear that these programs are important for all kids, and all kids can participate. The programs will get better. We're going to increase the demand for high-quality early ed. That's going to affect all programs. It will affect all parents. So we think, let me say through osmosis, but we think it will filter into, so I don't think you have to go as far as universal. In fact, we've argued that's not the place to start. Start with the at-risk kids. Do it well. Publicize the importance. When I was in Turkey, I saw signs all over Istanbul. Seven is too late. This is an organization like Ready for K in Istanbul. Seven is when kids in Turkey begin school. And all these signs were seven is too late. And the whole point is to educate the community about how critical those early years are. So I think you need organizations like Ready for K to keep promoting this, but I think this focused approach on at-risk will also help.
Okay, perfect. Next we have Representative Garofalo.
Madam Chair and the testifier, help me understand how these programs, in terms of the impact of the child, what I'm driving from the article that we've read in your testimony is that the impact is greatest because of the behavior change in the family life at home. Help me understand how something as small as 2.5 hours, or I guess the parental visits are 1.5 hours, correct? Mm-hmm. Correct. Help me understand how 1.5 hour visits can have such a dramatic, long-term change in behavior outside of the instruction period. And thanks.
Dr. Rowley?
We don't have the data to show this, but I had the opportunity to go on some field trips with public health nurses to some very at-risk families. So it's hard to understand this for me, but I go into these homes and the parent doesn't interact with the child. The public health nurse comes in with a basket of things, of books, of some treats, and starts talking to the mom and to the child. And gets this interaction going and does this 2-3 times and becomes, I'm going to call Aunt Sally, becomes very well accepted into the family. And there's a sense through her actions establishes this pattern of interaction and good parenting. And so what we're finding is, and it may be the most important part of the program that we're talking about for the at-risk families, is getting the mentors into the home. Even a couple hours, 2-3 hours a week can make a huge difference in getting interaction between the parent and the child. And the brain development people will tell you that bonding is critical. So it wasn't intuitive to me until I saw it. And in this one particular case, I think she actually saved the baby's life because the mom didn't know how to administer certain drugs that this baby needed. So I think it's critical, especially when there's kids raising kids, that this mentoring goes on. It's not an expensive part of our program, but I think it may be a very critical part and a very high return part. And as suggested by the Procter Gamble study that started prenatal, you can make a huge difference in outcomes.
Is it an oversimplification for me to look at this and almost try to narrow it down as a parent coaching program to help
parents become better parents, and that's where, again, when we're in a world of limited resources, that's where the resources should be. Because as an engineer, I'm skeptical that 2.5 hours, such a short time, can have such a profound effect. I mean, data is data, but you know what I mean? Is the parent coaching part of it? Is that what we're going to see most?
Dr. Rolnick?
That's my guess. I'll be able to tell you better in a couple of years. When I was in Seattle, and I was in a place called Child Haven. Child Haven only works with abused and neglected children. And that's the most at risk. There it's more intensive, but they spent an awful lot of time, their words, parent coaches. It's a therapeutic approach. The teachers are the bus drivers, and they actually go to the family. And they're working with some very difficult cases, and they've got longitudinal studies that show a high degree of success. It's going to vary as to how much parent coaching a family is going to need, and our program is customized, so the mentor will tell us how much that parent needs. In some cases, it may need, if it's a addicted mom, for example, it may need more. These mentors also are going to help the parents connect up the existing social services. All the things that we talk about are building on existing systems. So we think we can get a better, a better result. And I think your words, parent coaching, are very good ones. It may sound a bit simple, but we think the research is awfully powerful here, that if you get a child in a better environment, that brain is going to develop normally, and you will get the kind of returns we're talking about.
Last question, Madam Chair.
Representative Graffo.
Can you give the members of this committee some insight? Will the in the next open market meeting, will the Federal Reserve be lowering interest rates?
Dr. Rolnick?
Madam Chair, that's my father-in-law question, and I say there's a 50-50 chance we might do something.
Thanks. Thank you. We have two more questions, and then they'll probably bring us right to about 5:30. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up a bit with the providers. The idea of the scholarships going to providers that are well qualified is a really great idea. Do we have a quality rating system in place? Are you putting one in place? And is that system going to be based on inputs or in the value added for the student? Do we have any way of assessing, a student's progress that young? Those are just some of the questions, and is MELF going to, or is the foundation going to pursue some of those issues, and when will that be in place?
Dr. Rowley.
So I have to, in all transparency, this was my youngest child's kindergarten teacher.
Oh.
So we have a conflict here.
We won't say how old he is. Well, I think we can move ahead.
We can move ahead. It's a good question for Melvin. He is looking at the quality rating system. It will initially be input-based, although economists, we want outcomes. And over time, we're going to know if the programs that we identify as high quality based on inputs are actually producing, because we're going to know how many of these kids, what we expect all of our scholarship kids to pass the Minnesota Readiness Test. And we will know over time which programs are moving in that direction. But the quality rating system starts with inputs. We'll have some history on some of the programs. We won't get it all exactly right. I make a comparison to General Mills introducing a new product in the market. There's going to be some testing there. But I think we know an awful lot about what it takes for high-quality early ed. So we're going to have some standards in place for inputs. But I think over time, the mentors and the parents are going to tell us where the good programs are. Just like middle-class parents do it, we're going to empower at-risk parents to behave the exact same way, and they're going to feed us information about which programs. And if they don't like a Head Start program or they don't like a Montessori program, they're going to have the power to switch, and we'll have that data.
Thank you. And Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Peterson sort of asked my question, but I would like to piggyback on Representative Groffalo's question. I firmly believe even half an hour a week makes a huge difference on a baby, because I have a daughter-in-law who's a prenatal nurse, and they lose a couple babies a week because they're born so early they just can't live. But she can see the response, because the nurse, some of these babies will will be held and coddled by every single nurse that comes on that floor. And there's one baby waiting for a kidney transplant, but it has to be so many months old, like 8 or 9 months old, before they can do it. And this baby responds to all the nurses. They're worried that when the baby goes home, the mother won't give them the same kind of attention. But I used to tease my wife, because when our little one, our firstborn, was just sitting, you know, about this big, you know, sitting on a countertop in the bassinet, she'd carry on this conversation at length. Now, my wife could talk forever, so it was not a problem for her. And I come home and said, "Who are you talking to?" "Jason." "What's he saying back?" "Oh, he just smiles, you know." But that's the key. There's some interaction there, and I think that's one of the main things that these at-risk families have, is the mom, probably the dad is absent most of the time, I would expect, or not even there, but the mom may not be old enough to understand or has never learned. And so when you talk about 2.5 hours a week where that mom gets to watch how this nurse interacts with the child, and then she starts seeing that baby smile and goo-goo at him, and all of a sudden there's eye contact. And so I guess I'm kind of on board with this whole idea.
Madam Chair, can we take them on the road with us?
Yeah. Permission granted.
I'd like to get one question, Madam Chair. Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I have one more
Representative Eastland
comment question? Just when Representative Wardlow was talking, I just kind of occurred to me, maybe you don't know the answer to this, kind of a shift of gears totally, but what do you think the influence of electronics is on parenting? The amount of time that we spend interacting with a TV, a computer, an internet, parents and kids, both. I mean, so we're actually spending our life interacting with inanimate things.
Dr. Rolnick, Mr. Grunwald?
Madam Chair, and ironically, I was just in Brainerd up in Representative Ward's district, and there was a worker at the school district, Beth, and I have her last name in my notes, but she was citing some research that there has been a difference in brain patterns just because we haven't spent as much face time with children, even among affluent parents, because we are involved in electronics or other forms of communication. So actually the physical face-to-face contact that may have been more prevalent 50 years ago is now changed.
Thank you. Representative Lane?
Just a quick comment. You have two parts to this: parent mentors and early childhood programs. I did not hear the first in the governor's proposal, and I think that that's equally important.
Thank you. Any comments, Dr. Rolnick?
I agree.
Thank you. Well, thank you for coming. I would like to kind of hold all of you, Arthur Reynolds and Art Rolnick and Rob Grunwald, as kind of our committee experts to some degree. So I hope you'll be open to taking phone calls or taking us on the road or helping us understand this better, because we need your expertise and we need people we can turn to if we have questions. So thank you. With that, this committee is adjourned.